Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello, I'm Matt Hansen.
And I'm Tristan Riddell.
And you're listening to the Nerd Party, Oscar Edition.
Talk nerdy to me.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
All right. Thank you so much for listening. This is episode 17. And as Matt said at the beginning of the episode, this is the Oscar edition. Woo! Now, people who are huge movie fans like Matt and I, we love the Oscars, not so much for the awards or for the ceremonies, but just because it gets people talking about movies.
Yeah, it's a celebration of cinema and movies in general. And, you know, despite what people might think of the nominations each year, it's just fun to talk about movies. And that's what we like doing here on this show. So we're going to do an Oscar show.
That's right. That's right. Think of the Oscars what you will. I mean, whether they're like, oh, it's just another excuse for Hollywood to pat each other on the back, or it's just another excuse for rich folk to get awards, or, you know, like for mediocre people to have golden statues, however you look at them, people talk about them. We all love movies, and that's what we're going to celebrate here, is not so much the awards or the nominations or what the Oscars are or aren't, but we're going to celebrate the movies.
Definitely.
And before we get into what we're going to do is, like, for this show, we're going to talk about our top five Best Picture winners, our favorite movies that have won Best Picture, not nominated, won, because there are so many great films out there that have been nominated for Best Picture that haven't won, but that I might actually like more than the ones that are in my list. But we wanted to narrow it down. We wanted to keep it simple. But before we get into that, we should talk about the Best Picture nominees of this year, the 87 annual Oscar awards. And here is a list of the Best Pictures: American Sniper, Birdman or The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance, Boyhood, The Grand Budapest Hotel, The Imitation Game, Selma, The Theory of Everything, and Whiplash.
They went back on the large number of Best Picture nominees this year, because they changed it not too long ago to where it was 10. Remember that? And even that felt like it was way too much. So I wonder if they're... This is... What is this? 7?
8.
8. So they only cut back on 2. But still, you would think us being movie fans, you know, of course we keep up on the movie culture, but I'm the one who's seen all these, and you've only seen one.
I know, you suck. It's okay. Here's the thing. I was like, I'm embarrassed that I've only seen one of these out of the 8 Best Picture winners. And I want to see all of them, and I'm going to see all of them. But here's the thing, is that I don't like going to the theater anymore. And those of you who listen to the show regularly know that that's how I feel. I don't like going to the theater. I don't like it.
And if you haven't listened to the show, if this is your first episode, Tristan is the curmudgeon of the podcast.
I am definitely the old man between the two of us. I don't like... I think lots of times, people are talking, people smell. I've seen teenage girls
too.
Take selfies with what?
You probably smell too.
I do. I've literally seen teenage girls take selfies with the flash on while the movie was going on. I've seen old people and young people sit behind me and practically scream at the screen. And, like, most of the times it's out of focus or it's off to the left. And when I'm home, it's me and my wife. It's complete darkness. I have control over the volume. And I have a big-ass TV. And it's just... I get the perfect movie-going experience every single time if I watch it at home. When I go to the theater, it's a gamble of 70-30. 70% of the time, it's probably going to be a horrible experience because I'm going to tell someone to shut up. And I do, 7 times out of 10, tell somebody to shut up. Ah!
Tristan's allergic to people.
I don't like people, I don't like crowds, and I don't like selfish people. Because when you're in a theater, it's supposed to be a communal experience. You're supposed to enjoy the film because, yes, I understand that I lose a little something, because when you watch it as a community, you feed off of the vibe of other people. If they're laughing, you're probably going to laugh. If they're scared, you're probably going to be scared. And so when it's just me and my wife, you know, we lose a little bit of that, but it's worth it because I don't like selfish people. And when you are there, when you're in the theater, and you're talking, or you're on your cell phone, or you're trying to check your text messages, you're taking a picture of yourself, you're just, you are ignoring the other people around you. You are a selfish bastard who is ignoring everyone around you, because it's not just about you. If you want to act like you're in your living room, go to your living room like I do. There you go.
Say it like you mean it next time.
I just can't stand it. I mean, like, every single movie I go to, somebody is on their phone. Somebody is on their phone, and it illuminates the entire room. They think that they're in a vacuum. And it's not just a particular demographic. It's not just a particular race. It's not just a particular age. It's everybody. White, black, Asian, old, young, middle-aged, parents, non-parents. Every single type of person does this, and I die a little inside
every single time
I go to the movie.
Okay, breathe. Tristan, breathe.
I don't know if I can.
We're not at the movie theater right now. You're in your office.
I'm okay. I'm in my home office at home, in my home, not in theater. Okay. And that's why I haven't seen it. So long story short, that's why I haven't seen these movies.
And the reason I have, just to be fair to Tristan, is I'm single, I've got a good paying job, and I've got lots of free time. And I like movies, so. I don't mind the theaters.
So yeah, like I, you know, like my wife and I, we love movies. We both have well-paying jobs, and so we could be going to the movies every weekend, but we both can't stand people. So, like, I'm happy that you get to, and I'm happy that you enjoy it, because you get to enjoy it for both of us.
And as we record this, I've seen all these ones except for Boyhood. But as I told Tristan, the minute we finish doing this podcast, I'm on my way to a theater to go see it.
So, a lot of the people that I've spoken with who have seen all of these. Believe that Boyhood's going to win. Now, it won Best Picture at the Golden Globes.
Yeah.
What do you think, out of the ones that you've seen?
I think it is going to win, only because it might actually be a good film, and I'll find out this afternoon. I've heard nothing but good things. But if you've noticed, there also is a love of not only good films, but interesting filmmaking. And I think the novelty of how this film was made is going to push it over the top for a lot of voters.
And I think you're right, just from... like from the limited stuff that I know about these movies now, but I know I'm speaking out of ignorance, but here's my reasoning why I think it's going to win, is because it's the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. Now, a lot of people forget that last part, arts and sciences. That's why Gravity won so much, is because how it pushed the technology. Now, was it the best picture?
Didn't win best picture.
No. Well, no, I know it didn't win Best Picture, but it won a lot of awards, and it won the awards that it should have.
Yes.
But a lot of people were saying, like, why was it even nominated? And the reason why is because of the science that it pushed. And so I think that's why Boyhood is going to go forward, and not because of, like, it pushed any kind of technical boundaries, but because it was such a... what's the word I'm looking for? It was such a...
It's innovative. It's kind of, you know, if we think about it, I don't know another movie that's been made like this, where you shoot a little bit every year and you release it after a long-term 12 years with the same actors getting back together every year. I've never heard of that before.
Ambitious, I think the word is what I was looking for, is that it was very ambitious, and it pulled it off. I mean, like, I tracked this movie... 12 years ago. I knew this was going on 12 years ago, and because I'm a big Richard Linklater fan.
Are you really?
And yeah, I am. I like his work. And so when I heard that he was doing this, and one of my favorite actors, Ethan Hawke, was doing it, I was like, wow, this is crazy. No one's ever done this before.
I'm a newly converted Linklater fan. I just watched, for the first time, actually, this month, I watched the Before trilogy.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
What'd you think?
I'd never seen... they're my favorite romantic films now. They really
absolutely
are.
Right?
Yeah, and side note, Ethan Hawke in that first one is like my dream guy. Like, that's I want to go on a date with him in that first one.
Yeah, Ethan Hawke in Before Sunrise, the first one, it definitely is at his most dreamiest.
No, but I like that personality that he plays in that one, too. But those films are just, they're nothing but people talking, but they're never boring. And that, I've gone on so many dates, or that's, spoiler alert, into my personal life, that's my perfect kind of day, is where you just talk to somebody for hours.
Yeah, it is it's a good movie. It's also a good date movie. And it's the collaboration between the three of them,
right. Between
Linklater, Julie Delpy, and Ethan Hawke are... it's very solid, because in Before Sunset, like, I love this, because Before Sunrise was in 95.
Yeah.
And Before Sunset is in 2004. And Before Midnight is in 2013.
And I'm actually in the middle of Before Midnight right now. I was watching it early this morning.
Okay. Well, I won't give anything away because it's just, these are solid performances. And it's just talking. But like you said, it's never boring. And there's so much time in between them that it's, you actually do want to catch up on what happened because so much time has went on.
Right.
It's
the one time where a sequel that's released so far after the original is a good thing.
Yes, because if it was just 2 years, it'd be like, okay, well, you know, how much do we really need to catch up on if it's just been 2 years?
But 9 years, that's a long time. So bringing it about to the Oscars, I'm now looking forward to seeing Boyhood more now that I've seen the Before trilogy because it is the same director and one of the same lead actors.
Now, do yourself a favor and watch Waking Life.
Yeah, I heard that the characters from Before are actually in a segment of that movie.
But the thing is, now that you've seen Before Sunset, the segment in Waking Life doesn't really make sense.
Yeah, I heard it's an alternate reality sort of thing.
Yeah, it's good though. It's good though. Okay, take Boyhood out of the equation, because from what we've been hearing, the buzz online, buzz from other industry people, Boyhood, it has a big chance on winning. So, but you haven't seen Boyhood, neither have I. So, taking Boyhood out of the eight, out of the other seven, which do you think deserves Best Picture?
Well, the one that I don't know if it deserves Best Picture, but the one I liked the most out of that one is the one that I talked about during our Best of 2014 list, and that was The Imitation Game. And that's solely it's for a number of reasons, actually. I'm an unapologetic Cumberbatch fan. I just am now, as are many, many people. But I thought that I actually learned something, whether it's all totally accurate or not, because, you know, movies take liberties. But I learned something about history that I didn't know, and I thought it was a fascinating story, and the performances were engaging, and I thought it was really great. I was totally enthralled for, you know, the 2 hours that it was playing. So that's the one I liked the most.
Fantastic. Well, the two that I want to see the most out of the eight is The Theory of Everything and The Imitation
Game. Which was also really good. Theory of Everything was it's hard to pick between those two that were fascinating, because I learned a lot from both. But both are good films. You should check them out.
And I'm only just a little bit hurt, that Gone Girl isn't in there. But, you know, whatever. It's fine.
A little bit hurt. It's fine. A little bit hurt. If anyone was following Tristan on the day that these things were announced, you would have thought, you know, I don't know, someone slapped David Fincher right in front of him.
Okay, here's the thing, is that I hate being that person who's like, what? This is BS. What? My favorite movie didn't get nominated. The Oscars are just a bunch of BS.
I really was shocked, if you want my personal opinion, because there was so much buzz around that film.
Yeah, but there really was. And it only got one nomination.
The one that's deserved, by the way. But
oh, yeah. Rosamund Pike deserves her nomination for Best Actress. She's not going to win.
No.
But she deserves that nomination. And it's just so strange, because Fincher's movies, especially his last three, have gotten so many nominations for editing and for music and for even for directing now. And it's really strange that, I mean, there was so much, like, before the movie came out, and even when it came out, even before the nominations came out, they were saying Gone Girl, like, here's our predictions. And Gone Girl was everywhere, and it got nothing except for Rosamund Pike. But actually, like I said, I was like, I hate to be that person who just complains about their movies not being nominated, but I am today.
You talk about Fincher, though. I mean, just real briefly, I'm thinking back to his last few films, and Social Network and Prior, his films have all gotten plenty of nominations. And I think that's because as much out there as Fincher can be, and he makes some really dark, depressing films, they were pretty, you know, Benjamin Button a little bit, but Social Network and Prior, they were all pretty, not vanilla, but mainstream enough where I think that most Academy voters, again, because these are older people, could gravitate toward. Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and Gone Girl are very much darker, more Fincher into those films, and that, I think, that might have been a deterrent for a lot of people. I'm just guessing, though. That's my prediction.
Okay, so, like, here, the thing with Gone Girl is that I wasn't aware of this, and call me stupid, call me what you will, but I didn't know that there was such division about Gone Girl. I had no idea that it was so polarizing.
Right.
And now I remember you and I talked about the film, and we talked about how like, oh, how can you consider this a feminist movie? And other people are like, how can you not consider this a feminist movie? And I remember when the nominations came out and Gone Girl was nowhere except for Rosamund Pike, a lot of, like, there was a lot of women who were saying this is BS, and then there was a lot of men saying, no, that was a horrible movie. And it was, I, just from my limited viewpoint, which is very limited because it's only my viewpoint, from what I saw, women were angry and men weren't. And so it's just really confusing. And with the knowledge, knowing that it's like 92% men at the Academy, maybe some of that polarization happened in the Academy, and it's just like,
maybe they so. And we never really discussed why it was considered a feminist film, and I had my own opinion on that, and I'll just share with you now. And spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't seen it yet, it's on demand. I think it's on Blu-ray at this point. So
it is now.
If you haven't seen it, you should see it. But I think the reason it's considered feminist in a sense, Tristan, is because if you think about it, by the end of this film, she might be screwed up, but the woman comes out on top and is never not in charge the whole movie.
Well, I think I was able, because when I was confused about whether or not it was a feminist film, it was literally 30 minutes after I saw the movie for the first time in the theater. And
I know, but you happened to text me within those 30 minutes and you started asking me why it's considered feminist. That's my honest opinion. I think it's because the woman is in charge the whole time. She's the puppet master behind the whole things and and comes out on top. She gets what she wants in the end.
I know, but here's the thing. Here's my reasoning why is, like, I'm not confused anymore, because I do think it's a feminist film, because ever since then I've watched it 5 times. Maybe four. 4 times. Including the theatrical version. Yeah, I've seen it three times on home video. Mm-hmm. And I'm in the middle of reading the novel. This is very much a feminist film because it deals with the roles of men and women. It deals with how they tackle things differently and their perspective of each other. And not just a man and a woman, but men and women in a stereotypical sense. And so I think the reason why it's a feminist film is because it preys on the stereotypes.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Because, you know, for the first half of, from what I understand the novel, in the first half of the movie, you really think that this woman could be the victim here in this situation, as mm-hmm. is mostly the case when you have, you know, a woman, you're investigating the disappearance of the woman. And, you know, the great beauty of it is, and why I think it's considered feminist, is she's not the victim. She's the perpetrator. She's the mastermind.
Yeah. And that is why it's a feminist film. Yes. Yes, it turns it on its head. It turns the story on its head halfway through the film. Watch it. Okay, well, we've talked a lot about that. And now it is time to go into our top 5 Best Picture winners that we enjoy.
As you said, Tristan, I mean, we might have not have liked these films more than some of the others that were nominated, but you can't deny that in the history of the Academy Awards, some really classic films have won Best Picture. And we're going to talk about absolutely. Some of those.
Some really great films have won some Best Picture, and some really great films have been looked over. That's just the nature of awards. That's just how it is. I mean, the Oscars aren't the end-all be-all, but it's a great place to start. And so we're going to elaborate on that a little bit more. So, Matt, I went in temporal order with my 5 down to 1. And so what order did you go in? Did you go in favorites?
Yeah, I went in favorites, so this should be an interesting list.
All right, well, give us your number 5.
My number 5 is a movie that kind of has been crapped on a little bit in its history ever since it won Best Picture for being too cheesy or too hokey. But for me, it's part of its charm, and I really like the movie, and it's Forrest Gump from 1994.
That's my number 3.
Is it really? Okay, good. The good that we're in the same boat. Yeah, people say it's cheesy, and yeah, it is kind of cheesy, but it's really heartwarming, and it's kind of fun to see the technology, because you talked about the sciences portion of, you know, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. This is the first time that technology allowed him to be inserted into footage with Richard Nixon and with, you know, let him take part in American history, which was really fun. It, you know, people say it's unbelievable, and sure it is, but it's a movie, for God's sake. Mm-hmm. And just seeing that technology at work for the first time was really cool. You know, us as Star Trek fans, that's what let them make that technology that Robert Zemeckis pioneered is what let them make Trials and Tribulations 3 years later. So,
yeah.
So it really was a step forward, and it's a heartwarming story. I really liked. I'm a Tom Hanks fan, unabashed. So,
I mean, how can you not be? Like, if you say that you're not a Tom Hanks fan, I don't really believe you.
Neither do I. Because you're just saying you hate a nice person.
So, yeah, no, Forrest Gump, I think it's I think it's fashionable to hate on Forrest Gump today, and I don't know why. It's a corny movie, it's a cheesy movie, but it's heartwarming at the same time, and you get to see this individual go through almost his entire life, and it just the great things that happen, and the peaks and the valleys, and the odd things he does. And I mean, someone who went through that time, I mean, say what you want about the baby boomers and what they've done to this country, what they haven't done to this country. They have lived through some amazing times. And it's just like the Vietnam War, man on the moon, presidential assassinations, like not always, I'm not saying always good, but they are great and amazing in the purest form of the word. And so to see that through a lens of an idiot is quite, you know, entertaining. And it's just, you start to realize that he's not an idiot, and that he's, you know, like there are different forms of intelligence. And I know that I think a friend of mine who's a cinematographer, he likes this movie too, but he says that one of the many criticisms of the movie is that if you watch it and you analyze it a little bit deeper, it's saying that if you follow the system, if you listen to the government, and if you follow the established social norms, you will get ahead in life and you will win. But if anybody who bucks the system dies or becomes a crack addict or something like that, or loses their legs or something like that, it's just, but if you follow the way things are established, you will win.
I'm not calling your friend a liar or anything. It's just kind of like, I kind of think that when people are looking for things to criticize in a movie, that they really overanalyze a lot of things, in my opinion.
Yeah. But no, he likes the movie, but yeah, he, I know. Like he was just saying, that's one of the criticisms, but you know, I think it's looking a little bit too deep in there.
Yeah. That's what I mean. It's like you can find anything you really want to see if you look hard enough.
Exactly.
But also too, you know, before we move off this, much like this last year with Guardians of the Galaxy, Forrest Gump's got a killer soundtrack. I love that soundtrack.
It really does. And it came out with a double soundtrack because it had so much great music. And that's another thing about the baby boomers is that their music is 1,000 times better than what we were raised with or what our kids are going to be raised with.
Yeah. I mean, the movie I saw, I remember seeing it when I was younger, and it's part of the reason why, at least growing up for a period, I only listened to the stuff that was made from the 50s through the 80s. I mean, like, that's the music I was raised on.
Same here. All right, well, my number five, or at least, like I said, I was going in temporal order, which is kind of maybe somewhat in the same kind of order. I don't know. It jumps around a little bit, but Ben-Hur.
Yes, I do remember you talking about this movie. You really like this one. And it's
I really like this
movie. It's every definition of the word movie epic, because that was such a grand scale film for its time.
Yeah, very much so. Like this is the definition of an epic. Like if this movie wasn't if this movie wasn't made, we might not use the word epic as much as we do when it comes to movies. And this is a Charlton Heston, and you know I'm a big Charlton Heston fan, and just, I mean, the chariot race on its own is epic. And if just that one scene, and it's absolutely amazing how it was shot, how it was edited, the story behind the movie, how it got made. And it holds up today. Like you could watch it today. Like, yes, you can tell that it was made in the past because it was made in the past. You just can't hide around that. But the way that it's cut together, the way that the story progresses, the performances that are made, it's an amazing film, and you haven't seen it, please take the weekend off from work and watch it, because it's still going on. It's a very long film.
It'll be playing as you get ready for work Monday morning. It'll be finishing up.
And one thing that I really enjoy about this movie, and the full title of the movie is Ben-Hur: A Tale of the Christ, and like that was the name of the book. And like when they advertised Ben-Hur, it was just named Ben-Hur. Like on the posters and everything, it's just named Ben-Hur. But when you watch the movie, that's in the title card, Ben-Hur: A Tale of the Christ. And it's really interesting how it, like, his life follows Christ and is affected by Christ. And I just think that's an aspect to the film. And say what you want about religion or about Jesus, but I just love the parallels that are shown and how Ben-Hur is in the same time in the same area and location as Christ, and it just it's a really cool dynamic. And it had a budget of $15 million and made 146,
which is huge for that, especially for that era. That's like making over a billion these days.
I know, and that's just in the initial release. That's not even adjusted for how much it's made in re-releases.
Yeah, totally.
And so that's just, I think it's a great film. It's a part of our history, and I think you guys need to watch it if you haven't. If you have any interest in film, that you need to watch this movie.
Good choice. We're off to a rousing start.
So what's your number four?
My number four is a movie that I'm willing to bet, because of my age and also because of my race, people might not think I've seen. But I have seen, and it's actually one of my favorite films because it's of its time, and I'll explain what that means. But my number four is the 1967 Best Picture winner, In the Heat of the Night.
Oh, that's a good movie.
And, okay, so you've seen it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. My mom is a huge In the Heat of the Night fan, the movie and the TV show.
Yeah, I knew it was a TV show before I knew it was a movie, but I've seen the movie. And, again, it is dated because it is of its time, but this movie is one of those movies that needs to be of its time. That's mm-hmm. why it's so culturally significant, because for those of you who don't know, this is a movie where, there's been a murder in a smaller Mississippi town, and Sidney Poitier is helping with this investigation. He plays a detective from, I think it's from Pennsylvania, and he ends up being paired with this, you know, sheriff who's racist. And, you know, it's Mississippi in 1967. So we're in the mm-hmm. middle of the civil rights movement. We're in the deep, deep South. I mean, Martin Luther King is still alive at this point. Let's not forget. He's not killed until the next year. So it's right in the middle of all that sort of thing. And, you know, they're having to work together to solve this murder. And you just see these racial dynamics played out at a time when that's not a safe thing to do in films. Like, we mentioned at the beginning of the show that Selma is one of the nominees for Best Picture. It's a good movie, but the thing is that we can make a movie like Selma today because we're all, I hope, on the side of civil rights. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, everybody will embrace that. This is a movie that's made at a time where that's not necessarily the popular opinion, certainly not in the South. And the reason I made this onto my list, and I'm sure you know this scene because it's one, in my opinion, it's the best scene in the film, even aside from they call me Mr. Tibbs scene.
Yeah.
That's the memorable line. The best scene in the film to me is at one point they have to go question this guy who runs a plantation, and this guy has black workers working for him. He's a terrible racist person. Sidney Poitier is talking to him, and you know, he's condescending to him, talking about, oh, you like this orchid? Because this orchid is much like the Negro. It needs care and love to help it flourish. And at one point, he realizes that they're questioning him about this murder, or Sidney Poitier is questioning him about this murder. And he's infuriated, and he's a racist, so he slaps Sidney Poitier, and without missing a beat, Sidney Poitier slaps him back. And, you know, he's stunned there. He sits there in silence and rage. And I read somewhere that that's the first time an African-American has struck a Caucasian person on screen in a mainstream.
I didn't know that. That's crazy.
In a mainstream Hollywood film. And just, there, you know, after he slaps him, he's humiliated. And he wants the white sheriff to arrest him, and the white sheriff doesn't. And go watch that scene. It's actually on YouTube. If nothing else, just go watch the scene. It's so powerful, and it makes for a really great film. So number four, In the Heat of the Night, 1967.
Yeah, this is a solid film, and that everybody needs to see. And I love that you brought that up, that this was released in 67, 1967. This is insane that this subject matter was addressed and dealt with in a movie in 1967. And it's sad that it's sad that it's still being addressed, but this is something special. This is a special movie. And Sidney Poitier is 87 years old.
Yeah, but he gives an incredible performance in this film.
Yeah, he always does a solid job. All right, well, my number four going down the list is The Godfather.
Yes.
And Now, you know, what can there be said about The Godfather that hasn't been said a million times? And we've talked about The Godfather before.
Now, question for you, Tristan, and I don't mean to spoil your list if this does, but did you select Godfather over Godfather 2, or does Godfather 2 make a future appearance on this list?
Godfather 2 doesn't make a future appearance on this list. I see The Godfather as one entity. You know, in my mind, The Godfather is The Godfather. Like, it represents all three, the entire world that was made with The Godfather movies. And so I didn't want to duplicate the list here, because Godfather 1 and Godfather Part 2 are very much the same movie in my mind. And not in a negative way, like I was joking about with you earlier with Wayne's World in our previous episode. But just... It's one cohesive thing to me. It's one story to be told. And so that's why I put it on this list, and just The Godfather. It's an amazing film. It's the film. It's second on most American lists of greatest movies ever made, next to Citizen Kane. And in the British Film Institute list, it's number one. And it's, what was that? Godfather Part Two is number one. I can't remember. See, that's the thing. I get it mixed up in my brain. Well,
people endlessly debate whether or not, you know, both films inevitably make a best picture, best picture list. It just depends on which one, personal preference between one and two.
It really comes down to that. And I think you're right. And so I'm not going to drone on about it, but that is my number four, because it's hard to get better than The Godfather.
I'm glad that was on your list. I feel like if it wasn't, it would be severely lacking.
Yes. I agree. What's your number three?
My number three is a recent one, and it's another case like the Imitation Game, where it's a part of history that, while it may have been somewhat dramatized, I learned a lot about, I didn't know about, and I was on the edge of my seat, because it's an Oscar thriller, which doesn't happen too often, and that was Argo from 2012.
Really? Argo's on your list?
I really liked that movie. It was one of the... that year in 2012, I didn't have my job yet, so I was much like you that year, where that was the only Best Picture nominee that I had seen. And I had no idea that that actually happened. Of course, you know, like I said, of course it's taken dramatic license, but it's really fun when you know the outcome of a movie, and yet it still makes you feel tense. Like, because you know the outcome, it's written in history, but you're still on the edge of your seat. And I did not stop unclenching the armrest of the theater seat for the entire run of the film. So of course that was one of my most memorable watches of any Oscar film. So of course it's on this list.
Well, I mean, I agree with you, and I never really thought of it that way, but I do like that perspective where, even though, like, you know, it's going to end well, it still keeps you on the edge of your seat. I like that. I like that because it's true. It's true. I mean, like I knew about the altercation before the movie came out, And I didn't know all of it, obviously, because a lot of it was classified for a long time. Mm-hmm. But it, I thought this was a very good movie. I don't know. It just, in my mind, I just didn't really, like, when I saw it, I did not think Best Picture. Like, I was really surprised when it got nominated and won for Best Picture, because I was like, hey, that's a good movie, but really, Best Picture?
I don't know if it was Best Picture. Again, like I said, I didn't see all the movies that year. I was happy that it won Best Picture, because it was a Best Picture movie that I loved. So
yeah, I mean, that's always a plus. That's always good. Well, my number three was Forrest Gump, so let's move on to your number two.
I have to keep talking.
Oh, well, I could give my number two.
No, it's okay, because I'm pretty sure my number two is not going to be your number two, so it's all good. My number two is a movie that I saw when I was in college, and I didn't expect to be as emotionally moved by it as I was. And say what you will about this movie, I think it's phenomenal, and that was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest from 1975.
That, you're right. That's not on my list, but that's a good movie. Like, here's the thing about that movie. I think it's a good movie more than I enjoy it.
Yeah. Here's the question I want to throw out to you. It's a great film. People should see it. Is it a movie that you can use the verb enjoy with? Because it's so, I mean, it is emotionally dark.
And it's emotionally draining as well.
Yeah, by the time that movie's over, you needed to take a moment. But the performances are so good, and it has such a great ensemble, including, you know, actors like, you know, I'm sure for most people don't know, Christopher Lloyd and Danny DeVito are among the Asylum group. And this is before they were names. So it's interesting to catch them pre-fame. But Jack Nicholson's fantastic. And I was already familiar, of course, as a Star Trek fan, with Louise Fletcher from Deep Space Nine as Kai Winn. Mm-hmm. And you see why she was cast as Kai Winn if you watch this film. Because she does that character. She's one of the, if not the most hated, one of the most hateable characters ever created for film.
Yeah, Nurse Ratched is right up there with Darth Vader.
I mean, in a sense, she's almost worse, because Darth Vader, you know that he's creating sinister stuff, and he speaks like he's evil. Not that that's a bad thing, but the thing about Nurse Ratched and then later Kai Winn is that not only will she, undermine you and destroy everything about you, she'll do it while she's smiling and pretending like it's for your own good.
I like her a whole lot more in this movie than I ever liked her as Kai Winn, just because I hate Kai Winn as a character.
Well, you're supposed to, though. See, that's the thing, is that, you know, I've heard you say that before. And I think with both Kai Winn and Nurse Ratched, the actress who plays it has to be hateable. And you really...
But the thing is, I enjoy watching Nurse Ratched being hateable. I don't enjoy watching Kai Winn. That's the difference for me.
I just don't get you, but you can you at least agree with me that by watching this movie, you see why she was cast as somebody like Kai Winn?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I can see why it was brilliant casting. Don't get me wrong.
So yeah, you know, great film, but you know, you might want to have a drink after you see it.
Yeah, it's one of those movies that you need to see. You may not enjoy it. You might not enjoy it, but it's definitely something that you need to see as a moviegoer. All right, well, I guess that brings it to number two for me. My number two is probably should be my number one, but these two movies, like my two and my one, are pretty high up there on my list. This one, this upcoming movie was my, if people ask me what my favorite movie was, and I'd say, like, if I had to give an answer, it would most likely be this movie. This, changed how I looked at movies. This changed how I perceived movie making. And this is something that really, it's just, I think it was one of the best written movies in a long time, one of the best acted and best shot, best edited. Just everything about this movie, this is like, if there was ever a perfect movie, this is close to it. And that's Gladiator from 2000.
Really? Because I hear a lot of differing opinions about this one, so I'm interested to see why it's so important for you.
What differing opinions?
A lot of people, you know, I just heard a lot of people speak negatively about that movie. So you know.
Really? I haven't heard anything negative about Gladiator. I really haven't.
Maybe it's just my own limited personal experience, but what makes it such a defining movie for you?
This movie... And this was Russell Crowe at the height of his power.
This is the height of his power. I think it's the first time I ever heard of him, quite frankly.
Like this movie made him a household name. And this won Best Picture, Best Actor in a Leading Role, Russell Crowe, Best Visual Effects, Best Costume Design, and Best Sound Mixing. And it was nominated for a whole lot more.
I was going to say, reading off that list, I'm surprised Joaquin Phoenix didn't win.
Oh, that was actually, it's funny that you bring that up. Because that was the year that I gave up on the Oscar of investing in the Oscars, like investing my emotions in the Oscars, was because when Joaquin Phoenix didn't win for Best Supporting Actor, I was like, well, all right, it doesn't matter. You know, like the Oscars are BS. Like if he's not going to win for one of the greatest evil performances of all time, then yeah. And I'm sure I'm going to get made fun of for saying that because it's not a sci-fi
movie.
But
2000, you were young and impulsive.
It's true. It's true. I was young and impulsive. But the thing is, though, is that Joaquin Phoenix as Commodus is a fantastic villain. Joaquin Phoenix is an amazing actor. Say what you want about him, but he makes an amazing evil villain. And it's just, I never thought I'd see that happen. And it's
to
just...
To be perfectly honest with you, I remember him more for the movie than Russell Crowe.
Well, I mean, he had some great scenes. And... Like this, like listen to this cast: Russell Crowe, Joaquin Phoenix, Connie Nielsen, Oliver Reed, Derek Jacobi, Dijamon Hansu, Richard Harris. Okay, Oliver Reed and Richard Harris aren't with us anymore, and Oliver Reed actually died during filming. They had to digitally place his head on somebody else's body in order to finish the movie.
So this was his last on screen appearance.
This was his last on screen appearance, and. This is one of the best screenplays I've ever read or watched.
Yeah, and, I was gonna say, what a way to go.
Right? And it was written by David Franzoni, John Logan, and William Nicholson. And it's just I have a soft spot in my heart for Ridley Scott. You know, you guys have heard me talk about him before, and it's just this was. It's just when I came home from that movie, because what happened was it was in 2000. I was 14, and it was an R-rated movie, and so I couldn't go see this on my own. My parents had to take me. So what my parents did was they watched it first, and then they brought me in, because they wanted to make sure it was okay. You know, I was 14. You know,
did they still sit next to you and cover your eyes at certain scenes?
No. They just wanted to make sure that there wasn't any garbage in it. And they were pleasantly surprised, because for an R-rated movie, yeah, it has some violence, but it actually has a lot of deceptive violence in the movie.
Yeah.
The editing makes you think you see a lot where you don't actually see that much. And I think that's why I got the R rating. And they're like, Tristan, you have to go see this movie. So they took me. And then on the ride home in the car, I was quoting the film. I was quoting that Maximus Decimus Meridius speech that he did. Mm-hmm. And my parents were just blown away that I could memorize it that fast. It's so I was quoting on the way home, and it's just, and when this movie came out, this was the first DVD I ever bought. Because that's when DVD was new.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in 2000, and I watched this nonstop. I would put it in, and I memorized the time code on my favorite part so I could type it in and go to it, because I remember that was a feature I just thought was amazing, on because you can type in time code on DVD players, and it would just go straight to that speech, the Maximus Decimus Meridius speech. You could go straight to, you know, like the final fight scene and everything like that. It had chapter skip and everything, and I was just blown away, and just everything about this movie, the look, the feel, everything. I know I'm talking forever and I apologize, but it's just amazing.
If you were doing the list like I was doing the list, instead of chronological favorites, would this be your number one?
Probably, but the one that is actually on my number one chronological is an amazing movie and is in my top 10. But Gladiator, I think Gladiator shaped how I viewed movies at a younger age, and my number one didn't really shape how I look at movies, but it is an amazing movie. So I think, yeah, it probably would be my number one. Yeah.
Cool.
All right, but I've been talking forever, and I apologize for droning on, because I have that tendency to do that. What is your number one?
Well, Tristan, you've known me pretty well. What do you think my number one is?
I don't know.
Try to think about the person I am.
Oh, you're putting me on the spot now.
And what I like, what genres I like.
Well, I mean, I would say Silence of the Lambs then.
Bingo.
Oh, awesome. That almost made my list. That was almost on my list. And I think Ben-Hur bumped it off.
Listeners, you know who I'm, you know me. You know I'm a fan of horror. And you know I like my scary stuff. And of course, my favorite Best Picture winner is Silence of the Lambs from 1991. There's nothing that hasn't already been said that I've said in previous episodes when I talked about the Hannibal TV show. But talk about not only a great cast, that's the first time I really paid attention to Anthony Hopkins, as the world did. Jodie Foster, that's her second Best Actress win. And actually, funny story about my number one and number two. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and The Silence of the Lambs are one of the two films in Oscar history to win all of the major five awards.
Hmm.
The only other one that ever did that ever was way back in the 30s with It Happened One Night.
That's another good movie.
But man, oh man, is this movie good. If you haven't seen it, go see it if you like that sort of thing. It is, it's horror, but it's psychological horror. And yeah, there is some gore in it, but again, especially even during the breakout scene, yeah, some of it is gory, but some of it is that implied or imagined things where you're not really seeing what's going on. You're just, you're hearing it, and you think you're seeing it, but you're not.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of implied horror in Silence of the Lambs. Like, one of its goriest scenes, or at least one of its more brutal scenes, is when he's beating that cop with his own baton. You're not actually seeing him beat the cop. You're seeing his reaction.
And not only that, you're hearing it, and he's also wearing a white shirt, so you're seeing the blood kind of splatter on him, but you're not seeing the aftermath. And even right. When he goes up to bite the other guy's face, you don't see him, like, teeth actually sink into skin.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's all done very cleverly. And really, one of my favorite scenes from any film, just on a performance level, is the scene between Clarice and Hannibal where she's talking about the lamb.
Yeah, it's funny that you, like, everybody refers to him and calls him Hannibal now, like, when they talk about him, like, in like, the scene with Hannibal, or, like, Hannibal walked in or something like that.
Yeah.
But before the TV show, we all called him Lecter.
Well, either way, that scene where she's talking about the lamb and running away from her uncle's farm is one of my favorite scenes in any movie.
Oh, no, that wasn't a criticism or anything like that. I'm just saying that's the effect that the TV show has had on our lexicon.
No, and I didn't
think
it was a criticism, but I'm just saying that that's why it's my number one, aside from the fact that I love that movie. That scene alone, the dialogue and the reaction shots. What I found fascinating is I watched a making-of documentary with the cast and the director, Jonathan Demme, and he said originally the way that scene was storyboarded was that as Clarice is telling him the story, they were going to cut back because to actually see it happen, like in flashback as she's talking. Because earlier in the film, you see a young actress playing Clarice as a child. And she was going to originally film the scene where she was carrying a lamb, and you were going to see this whole thing played out. But the thing is, as he's watching the dailies, he said to him and the editors, if I cut away from Jodie and Anthony during this speech, I will be laughed out of the Academy because the reaction shots from both of them are so good that I cannot afford to cut away from the scene. And so that's why it stayed as is. And I think that was the right choice, quite frankly.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And it would have been criminal to cut away because that is such an engaging scene. And that's the beauty of it. And I feel like that's something that's severely lacking in today's cinema is that it's a conversation. It's question and answer, and it's engaging and it's enthralling. And you don't see that done very well in modern times.
And the thing that I love also too about it, released on Valentine's Day that year in 1991.
I love that stuff.
And really, you know, the reason that they released it there is because February is a dumping ground. And the last time they tried to do a Lecter story with Manhunter, it didn't do very well. So they really were expecting this thing to bomb.
Yeah, and I bet they had no idea that it was going to get Best Picture or even start a phenomenon that it did.
I mean, pictures like that, even today, don't get Best Picture, a horror movie.
No, not at all. Not at all. Sci-fi and horror do not get Best Picture.
So, my favorite, Silence of the Lambs.
That almost made my list. And you know what? Thinking about it now, if I had to swap out something, I'd swap out Forrest Gump for Silence of the Lambs.
It would at least be an honorable mention on your list, would it not?
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, my number one, and I'm not going to talk long about my number one at all, is The Departed.
Of course, I should have known. Great movie.
It's a solid film. Solid actors all around. It made me actually enjoy Mark Wahlberg, and which I never thought would ever happen. And it's just Leonardo DiCaprio is at his finest, and I love Matt Damon. I think Alec Baldwin is hysterical in this movie. And
I recently went back and watched it. I did not know she was in it at the time, but now that I'm a big fan of her, Vera Farmiga's in the film.
That's right. She is. Yeah, Vera Farmiga. I was a fan of Vera Farmiga when she was in a TV show with Heath Ledger in the 90s called Roar.
Oh, I never heard of that.
Yeah, it was Heath Ledger's first American performance was a TV show called Roar. It lasted one series, and I was on Fox, and he plays a Scotsman who tries to unite the clans. But it has a fantasy tone to it.
That's awesome.
That's pretty nice. Yeah.
But as you know, she's now one of my favorite people. So I didn't remember that she was in The Departed until I saw it again.
Yeah, I love Vera Farmiga, and I'm so glad that she's popular now. And I mean, it's Scorsese. It's a Scorsese film. It's my favorite Scorsese film. And it's just, I love his style. I love his verve. And I think this is a tour de force, as people would say. So do you have any honorable mentions, my good friend?
You know, I think I'm spent after that. I mean, there's movies that I've enjoyed. Actually, I will mention one honorable mention because it's a film that I just saw recently. And haven't had time to digest enough to where it's become one of my favorites, but I really, really liked it. And I really, really liked, again, the filmmaking behind it. And that was The French Connection from 1971.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You can analyze that for years if you wanted to.
Specifically that L-train car chase in the middle of the film. Because that was, I mean, we've had James Bond and we've had car chases before then. Nothing was filmed like that before then.
No, and even the emotional connection about how he's willing to sacrifice people and put other people in danger just to catch him.
Yeah, so I love that movie. So that would be my honorable mention, French Connection.
My honorable mention is Rocky.
Oh, that's another good one. I wish I would have thought of that one.
Yeah, Rocky is a great movie, and the thing is I attached myself to this film later in life, because I was like, my parents didn't really like Rocky, and like it was on TV, but I never really took the time to invest in it, because like there was five of them at the time, and now six, and I was just kind of like, you know, whatever.
You never took the time to invest. See, I couldn't help but watch Rocky when I was like in fifth grade, because you remember the days of like USA, they would air these all five of them in marathons all the time. Whenever they had an excuse to, they would.
Yeah, somehow, but like I don't like boxing. And so I never really gave it a shot. But it turns out I like boxing movies. I just don't like boxing. And so,
yeah, me too.
And when I lived in Chinatown before I got married, and I had about five roommates, and one of them was obsessed with Rocky. And he says, he's like, promise me that you will watch Rocky today. And like, they all went off to work because I was looking for work. And so I watched it and I was like, holy crap, this was amazing. That was an amazing movie. And especially when you find out all the stories behind it, how he made it, how it was made, the invention of the Steadicam. You know, like this was the first use of a Steadicam was in this movie. And just everything behind it is just so phenomenal. It's a great underdog story, the definition of an underdog story. And he ends up not winning. I mean, an underdog story where he doesn't win. That's just amazing. And it was hardly ever done. And I immediately consumed the other films. And I even liked the sixth one. I even really liked that one, you know. And it's just like, yeah, it has its up and downs throughout the series, but it's really good. It's really good.
I'm an unapologetic fan of that film series, and I'll even stick my neck out for the corny ones. Like, I'll even say it. I like Rocky IV. That's like one of my favorite ones besides the first one.
Well, I mean, I think Rocky V is probably the lowest point.
Yeah, that one is the one series. I didn't like. But four, the cheesy 80s one is the one that I like.
Yeah, that is the definition of cheesy 80s is Rocky IV. Absolutely. All right, well, that's our show. We'd love to know what some of your favorite Best Picture winners are. And as we said before, this is not what we think are the best movies out of the Best Pictures. This is just our favorites. This is our personal opinions. These are movies that spoke to us and that mean something to us. So we'd love to know what some of your favorite Best Pictures winners are. You can find me on Twitter at The Insane Robin.
And you can find me at mhansen0207, H-A-N-S-E-N.
And you can also go to a website at thenerdparty.com where you can find our Tumblr page and find all of the episodes there. And we exist on every platform that you can think of. Podbean, Spreaker, Libsyn, wherever you, Burberry, everything.
And most of all, as we end the show into Oscar fashion, we just want to say, oh my God, this was totally unexpected. We just want to thank our fans, our parents, or everybody who helped make this show possible, and thank you so much. And as the band plays us out, thank you for listening to the Nerd Party.
Coming up next week.
Who am I? You sure you want to know? If somebody told you I was just your average ordinary guy, not a care in the world, somebody lied. Truth is, it wasn't always like this. There was a time when life was a lot less complicated. Can I take your picture for the school paper?
Sure. In this lab, we have 15 genetically enhanced super spiders.
There's 14. One's missing.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.